This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Winning words in the State of the Union drinking bingo game tonight? Let's try strong, inequality, and minimum wage. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Tuesday, the 28th of January. And we have come to that moment in the annual political cycle, gang, where a 45-minute speech by the President of the United States sucks up all the oxygen in the room. What he's going to say in the State of the Union, who's going to be in the gallery, what the opposition response might be. Some things, of course, we know already. That's just how this game is played, including part of his economic message that he is going to raise the minimum wage in new federal contracts to $10.10 an hour. He's also going to call on Congress to do the same for all workers. But other than the neat and tidy symmetry of the thing, why $10.10 an hour? Marketplace's Adrian Hill checks it out.
It was just last year's State of the Union when President Obama offered up this plan.
Let's declare that in the wealthiest nation on earth, no one who works full-time should have to live in poverty, and raise the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour.
Now he wants $10.10. A number from where? The short answer is a plan from two Democrats, Senator Tom Harkin and Representative George Miller. Julia Cray is a spokesperson for Miller.
It's going to lift a family of three with one full-time worker above the poverty line.
She says $10.10 will help restore the value the minimum wage has lost since its peak in the 60s. And it's in line with past increases.
This was the number that was settled at that sort of got at these three big things that we want to do. You know, it's a nice, easy number to repeat.
Way better than $10.09 or $9.97. So who's going to benefit from tonight's raise? I ask Amy Taub. She's an analyst at Demos, a progressive policy group. She says hundreds of thousands of federal contract workers currently make less than $10.10.
They are people cleaning floors in federal buildings. They are people who are taking care of the grounds in buildings.
David Van Slyke is a professor of business and government policy at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University.
I think what this really says is it shows just how dependent the federal government is on contractors.
He says, especially since the 80s, the government's done more and more contracting for all sorts of labor, jobs that'll soon pay at least $10.10 an hour. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
If you're watching the speech tonight, drinking or otherwise, you ought to watch it with us, I think. We'll stream the speech and translate it for you into English. Plus, you can ask questions or just comment along. It's all at marketplace.org. We'll be live tweeting as well, a bunch of our reporters and me. You can follow me at Kai Rizdal. All right, moving on. You come across stories every now and then that you kind of knew were happening all along and just didn't necessarily want to think about it. The most recent revelations, courtesy of Edward Snowden, are a good example. His latest leaks, printed in the New York Times and The Guardian, show that the National Security Agency has been snooping into the data collected by smartphone apps. Google Maps was one, but so was Angry Birds. I mentioned this on the way out yesterday, and lots of you responded. So we figured we'd dig into it a little bit to find out what Angry Birds knows that the NSA maybe doesn't. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that one.
Here are some basic things that your gaming app knows about you. First, it can tell whether you suck at the game.
It'll see that you're stuck in a particular part of the game, or most people are getting stuck.
That's Kelly McIver with mobile fundraising service TapFunder. But the game might move to the next level of data mining. like getting access to your GPS.
So they want to know, is this game really being played a lot in North America versus Asia versus wherever?
Emil Grafstra is with Atomic Mobile. Things move to a whole new level when social networks come into play. Will Regal is a marketing and advertising consultant.
By granting a game app access to your Facebook profile, you tell people what your birthday is, who your friends are.
When you start letting your game make Facebook posts about your score or whatever, then the data really starts pouring in. And then there's the info that you tell some apps when you register.
Sexual orientation or relationship status.
And not everyone is convinced that the information will always be anonymous. Apps may not always share that data, but the more data they collect, the more lucrative it is to share. Nathan Eagle is CEO of Jhana.
It's used for one purpose and one purpose only, to increase the probability that you click on that banner ad.
That, after all, is the highest level for most apps. Unless, of course, you're the NSA and you're hacking into app servers to get this data, then you have other purposes. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not really angry at all. Honestly, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are a whole lot of different things that go into school funding formulas. They can depend on where the money's coming from, state taxes or the federal government. Those formulas can vary by socioeconomic differences or academic achievement levels. I could go on, but suffice it to say, it's complicated. One thing does seem to be clear, though. The more schools depend on state dollars, the more district budgets change when the number of kids changes. And as demographics adjust, along with a still slow economy, rural schools are feeling their share of the pain, maybe more. Michigan Radio's Sarah Alvarez has that story.
In the school gym at Stockbridge Middle School in rural Michigan, a small group of eighth graders looks uncomfortable in mostly too big gym uniforms. Right now, they're playing basketball and volleyball. Next year, this school will be shut down, and the gymnasium is the only thing that will still be open to students. Dan Steffi is the gym teacher, and he feels this way about the whole thing.
Yeah, it's like,
Steffi has taught in this district for 35 years. He's sad about the closing, and his job is on the line.
And I will say, and I'm proud of this, that Stockbridge, we've been preparing for these types of situations for a long time. We've been lean and mean for a lot of years. Believe me, that's a fact.
The school district here isn't a big spender. And it's not poorly managed. By every measure the state has, Stockbridge is a good school district. But Superintendent Carl Heidrich says closing a school and cutting staff is the only way the district can stay in the black.
Look at this trend line here. It looks like we're losing about $500,000 in the last 2 years, so that's going to continue.
Families are moving away for lots of reasons.
Unemployment, housing market, commuting cost. Gasoline costs.
People aren't leaving in droves. It's more like a steady drip.
In 2001 and 2, we were 1,800 students.
Over the last decade, the schools here have lost about 350 kids. Pretty typical for a rural district these days. Each of those kids takes about $7,000 in state aid with them. So the district's budget has taken a $2.5 million hit.
Unfortunately, it came to this.
The plan is to close the middle school and move some of those kids to the high school and some to the elementary. Heidrich says it's worth it to keep the school from a deficit. When a school system is in deficit, the state can and has stepped in to take it over or shut the whole thing down.
We got to take care of our students, and we can't wait on the state. There's no guarantee of increased funding in the future. So we have to take care of our own.
The irony is that the schools are better now, even though money is tighter. They already outperform some of the bigger, richer districts nearby. And despite the whole budget crunch, people in Stockbridge are stoic and trying to stay positive. There is anger, but gym teacher Dan Steffi says it's directed outward.
I know the people here, everybody here is working hard. for the most part. You wonder what the state of Michigan is doing to education. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Right around the corner from the middle school, at a small table in the Village coffee shop, Chris Young is working on his laptop and taking a few calls. Young has a daughter in the district. He says he's willing to pay more in taxes if the district asks.
You have to take care of your house, so to speak, or it will fall down around you. This is a sleeper community. No one's coming to Stockbridge, so you have to have people that are committed to, you know, putting their kids first, and I see a lot of that go on.
In small towns across America, where the population is shrinking, that commitment to education is being tested. In Stockbridge, Michigan, I'm Sarah Alvarez for Marketplace.
The European Union has been pretty far out front in figuring out ways to take on climate change. It started the first real carbon market, putting a price on pollution, effectively. We'll forget, yes, just for the moment, that that hasn't worked out so well and give them credit for trying. How about that? Also, 7 years ago, the EU came up with binding country-by-country emissions targets, and it set some big goals for the use of renewable energy. But you know what? Global warming is really hard. So last week, the European Commission proposed some easier guidelines, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard tells us.
Do we want more renewables and efficiency in Europe?
Yes!
Climate campaigners in Brussels vent their discontent over the new European targets.
Although it's better than simply doing nothing at all, it's not an awful lot better.
Doug Parr of Greenpeace, he claims the world must cut carbon emissions by at least 55% before the year 2030, but the EU is proposing a 40% cut instead.
The leadership that the EU has displayed up till now is slipping back.
That leadership is a source of pride in Europe.
Are you worried about your future? And is climate change one of your concerns?
In this video, the EU brags about promoting and subsidising renewable energy, about creating green industries and making the fight against climate change profitable.
Europe is showing the way towards a safe and prosperous low-carbon future for our planet and our economy.
But Europe's new green energy target is another big letdown, say the critics. It commits the EU to produce a quarter of its energy from renewable sources like wind and solar by 2030. However, the target is not binding on each of the 28 individual member states. That could be a problem.
Some member states will be more virtuous and some member states will be less virtuous.
Monica Frassoni of the European Alliance to Save Energy says the member states will bicker over this commitment. The target will be hard to enforce and that won't encourage companies to invest and innovate.
The combined effect will be much less development and research of technologies on energy efficiency and renewables.
The European Commissioner for Climate Action has defended her targets. Connie Hedegaard says in these tough economic times, the Europeans would have rejected a more stringent, ambitious plan. At a news conference, she described her proposed reduction in greenhouse gas emissions as meaningful.
40% is not a small thing. It's a big thing. It will require a lot from Europe. And I can only say, if all other big economies followed our example, then the world would be in a much better place.
The trouble is, the other big economies have not followed Europe's example by adopting emissions targets. James Sproul of Britain's Institute of Directors.
The US, Asia, Canada, Latin America, nobody else is following down this path, which should be telling the Europeans something about both how achievable they are and the costs that might be entailed in that.
He says no one else wants to sacrifice economic growth in the name of saving the planet. And he says the new softer targets are a sign that Europe's enthusiasm for climate action is also waning. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up,
African Americans try to find some little pockets to sort of figure out how they could at least earn a little bit of money and indeed control their time.
Black barbers and their shops. But first, Let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 90 points today. That's about a 0.5%, wrapped at 15,928, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ rose 14 points, about a 0.3%, finished at 4,097. The S&P 500 added 10 points, 0.6%, ended things at 1792. Apple peeled off 8% today after missing projections for iPhone sales. Apple supplier Cirrus Logic failed 4.5% lower. Qualcomm disassembled 1.75%. Herbalife dispensed with 2.33% today after Canada launched a probe into whether the weight loss company runs a pyramid scheme. The mutual fund company T. Rowe Price climbed 5.5% today on strong quarterly profits. Bond prices up just a touch. The yield on the 10-year T-note held steady at 2.75%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. The American Highway Users Alliance holds a conference on winter road safety. Speaking of wintry goings-on, the U.S. National Snow Sculpting Competition gets underway in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. Power tools are not allowed. But if you're a fan of jigsaws, tomorrow is National Puzzle Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. For the office workers among you, me included actually, so among us, I suppose, your day probably goes like this. There you are, working away in front of your computer, and then, bam, something pops up on your screen and kills your momentum. It's email, it's Facebook, it's Twitter, you name it. It's distracting. Gloria Mark knows all about that. She's got an office job, too, down at the University of California, Irvine, where she studies how workers like us can do our thing more efficiently. Gloria, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Would it be a bad thing if I told you that I had my email up on the computer in the studio here while I was talking to you?
Yes, it would be bad because you would be distracted and you would not be focused on our conversation.
But I can do two things at once. Everybody can nowadays, right?
Well, you can, but there are consequences. You're not going to be giving all your attention to this interview.
To you, right? Yeah. If you could create the ideal working condition for a knowledge worker, right? The most productive, but also the most relaxed, what would it be?
So I would create an atmosphere where people would focus on one task for a period of time, where they could take short breaks every so often. So we find that taking a break and doing Facebook is actually quite a good way to distract yourself.
Now you've opened Pandora's box because people out there are going to hear this and they're going to say, oh, Facebook's all right at work. Twitter's okay at work.
Well, Facebook does not require a lot of focus.
No, it doesn't.
It's very different than a face-to-face interaction, which involves a bit of a commitment. And cumulatively, the more of these small interactions through Facebook, the happier people are at the end of the day.
What's the single worst thing for a knowledge worker?
I would say email. Email is not a quick interaction. We did a study where we cut off email in an organization for 5 days, and we found that without email, people were significantly more focused and they were significantly less stressed.
I'm going to sound like a total Luddite here and ask you, what about the good old-fashioned, you know, just going to get a cup of coffee with somebody? Is that not a good break and refreshing?
I think that's great. In fact, right, when we cut off email for 5 days, the people who participated were very happy and reported that they really enjoyed walking in over to other people's offices and talking with them face to face, and they really enjoyed it.
Gloria Mark is a professor of informatics at the University of California, Irvine. Gloria, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Time now for another installment in the long-running drama, The Death of Print. For decades, a lot of newspapers delivered their Sunday advertising supplements to everybody in their circulation area, not even non-subscribers. A lot of times that meant a short detour to the recycling bin as you walk back inside with the actual paper. And that, along with the way the print economy is changing, really, helps explain why we learned this week that the Chicago Tribune is about to end that practice. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
Sending the Sunday ads to everybody used to be great for advertisers. to make sure that every household in Chicago knew what the price of lettuce was going to be this week.
That's Owen Youngman from the Medill School of Journalism. And that, he says, was then.
Instead of one audience of 3 million, which the Tribune might have served on a Sunday with its million copies, it's 3 million audiences of one.
This practice of blanketing the whole circulation area with the ad supplement was actually an early innovation in using databases to target audiences. In this case, the trick was getting the database to tell you which households were subscribers and which weren't. That way you could promise advertisers they weren't paying to hit the same household twice. That data has only gotten more refined. Randy Novak is with NSA Media. They sell ads in local papers to national advertisers. He says it's not a million copies of the same ad that's getting distributed. It goes down to the zip code. Say I'm a grocer. I've got a store with lots of competitors. So one way to get customers is
by being much more competitive, say, with the price of milk. So if I'm selling it for $2.99 in a very competitive area and maybe $3.99 in a not-so-competitive area,
then I can target my Tribune ad to tell people what the price of milk is in their local store. Here's the other thing. The Trib actually has a new print product that's a hit, and Novak thinks its success has to do with why this blanket delivery is going away. And that print product? It's the Sunday ads. People actually sign up to subscribe to them. They just don't want the day-old news cluttering up their doorstep. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Black-owned barbershops are more than just places to get a shave and a haircut. They are, or they've become over time, places to talk about the events of the day, to swap stories, and to some degree to let African-American men become entrepreneurs and join the economy. Quincy Mills is a professor of history at Vassar College. His new book about the black barbershop in American economic life is called Cutting Along the Color Line. Professor Mills, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The popular perception, and I'll just generalize here, is that black barbershops are a place where a mostly all-black clientele goes to have their hair cut and talk about, you know, events of the day. Was not always that way, though, was it? I mean, you go way back.
Yeah, it wasn't always the case. Certainly in the 19th century, a majority of the commercial black-owned barbershops exclusively groomed wealthy white businessmen and politicians. And certainly this comes out of slavery. The black barbers were, in many cases, enslaved men, but also free blacks. This larger sort of story of black barbers grooming white men, I think, speaks to the ways in which African Americans try to find some little pockets to sort of figure out how they could at least earn a little bit of money and indeed control their time, which, of course, was what slaves did not have, control over their bodies and certainly their time.
And then what happens? Do they, after the war, do these skilled barbers, I mean, there are no barriers to entry, right? You open up a shop and you're in business. So is that what happens? They become economically self-sufficient?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It didn't cost a whole lot to open a shop. So it wasn't until the late 1880s, beginning 1890s, where a new generation of African Americans entered barbering. This generation was born after emancipation, and they explicitly opened shops in black communities, and they explicitly wanted to groom black men. Certainly this is the same time that Jim Crow is on the rise.
And then as these mostly black men, right, start cutting black men's hair and shaving black men, when do these barber shops become the public spaces, become the centers of black life in some ways, right? Because I mean, people go down there and they hang out and they talk and they commune.
Certainly during the Great Migration around World War I, African Americans in the South would congregate in barbershops to sort of talk about the possibilities of moving north.
Hmm.
Once they got to places like Chicago, barbershops and churches were one of the few places where one can get off the train and go to meet a group of people who had all sorts of connections and networks. And so barbershops sort of served as that larger space as African Americans were attempting to adjust to a new city.
This is a scholarly work of history, and we've talked a lot about history. But as we sit here in the early 21st century, with the economy changing all around us practically every time you turn around, are black barbershops as vital economically to the black community, and where do they fit into that landscape?
In our current economic climate, it's all about jobs.
Yeah.
Barbershops sit on the margins of that conversation because, to be real, they don't really employ a lot of people. Barbershops are not going to, you know, restart any economy. However, barbering still has very low barriers to entry. It might take about $150,000 to open a barbershop. So it's not cheap, but it's still possible, right? And so barbering still serves as that avenue for men, whether they want to own a barbershop or just work in a barbershop. But also, barbershops provide this sort of central hub, if you will, for communities across the country to understand the nature of their respective communities. And so I would argue that that's just as vital to an economy as is the number of jobs one can generate.
Quincy Mills is a professor of history at Vassar College. His book about black barbers and black barbershops in this country is called Cutting Along the Color Line. Professor Mills, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Oh, thank you very much, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, before which I will confess up front that I am late in getting my annual performance goals to my boss. So anybody at 8 p.m. up in St. Paul listening to this, just scoot on by this one, all right? Anyway, and I'm not sure we needed academic research to tell us this, but it turns out that pretty much everybody hates performance reviews. It's published in the Journal of Personnel Psychology, and it turns out like this. Eager beavers that you would expect to be eager for feedback, they obsess on any negative comments. Those who just want to get by and not be noticed, they just don't want to be perceived as failing. Me? I'll get my goals in soon. I promise. Really. I will. Tomorrow, maybe? I don't know. We're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Nancy Vargali and John Ketchum are the producers on our Marketplace desks. I can guarantee you they've got their goals. And I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, unless I get fired. I don't know. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.